Hello, and welcome to Torah in Motion's MP3 audio library. We hope you enjoy this recording of a live Torah in Motion presentation. For more information, please visit www.torahinmotion.org. Thank you.
It's not too often, and it's a pleasure for me to formally introduce my partner, I guess we could, in many ways, but really in the founding and the running of Torah in Motion. Elliot is the creative genius behind a lot of our programs and a lot of our activities, and really much of what you see in many of our programs is due to his input and his hard work and organizing and thinking of, and hopefully for many years we'll continue in the same path. It's also where we're partners, although we almost never see each other because we each teach at different branches at SHAF, but officially I teach. Elliot is the head of the department that I teach in, ethics, and but we're in different branches, but he's designed the whole curriculum. Of course, he teaches rabbinics, ethics, and philosophy at SHAF as well. He teaches at Queen's University, where he was over Shabbos running a Shabbaton, and he's taught at adjunct professor at the University of Waterloo, where Dr. Salkin is here. And he's written, he's appeared on CBC Radio, he's worked on a television series, and he's all around involved in all aspects of Jewish education, young and old. He holds a PhD from the University of Toronto in English Literature, where he taught for a number of years. And as I mentioned, he devotes himself now 110% into Jewish education, and it's a pleasure. I'm sure those of you who have heard him know he's a wonderful speaker, always very, very thought-provoking. So we'll have Elliot Achron Chabi.
I'm going to ask that you, any questions you might have, you leave to the end. I want to take a look today at what I think is the greatest spiritual challenge of the Haggadah and also the most intractable problem of the Haggadah, which is the wicked son or the wicked child. I want to review different attitudes towards this in Haggadot, and I specifically want to talk about it in light of doing education with children. We often talk about the Rasha and the Haggadah as if it lives in a vacuum, as if it's just something on a page, a piece of paper. But the truth is that children live, and children have different kinds of attitudes, and those children become us, they become adults. And adults are, as you all know, very complicated people. And so, too, I will argue, is the Rasha. And how we think about the Rasha is not just a textual issue for the Haggadah, it's a life issue for the future of Judaism. Because how we think about people with different ideological attitudes and religious practices in our time is, in my opinion, going to tell the tale on the future of the Jewish people. I'd like to begin with the passage itself, which you'll find on the top photocopy, and follow along with me. This is from what's known as the Hirsch Haggadah. Of course, the piece on the Arba Banim is from Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's piece called Ma'amar al Arba Banim, his treatise on the four kids. There are a number of salient points, really, off the top. The passage itself, what does it mean? Rasha Mahu Omer, the wicked child, what does he say? Ma'avodah hazot lachem, here quoting from Parshat Bo, taking a pasuk from Exodus 12:26. And the Haggadah then comments, lachem velo lo. It jumps on the language of the pasuk and says that it is a pasuk that is isolationist. He isolates himself by saying that it is for you and not for himself. And then it makes an ideological statement. It says, lufisho tziyad atzmo min haklal kafar biikar. So it says, you know, there are certain fundamentals in Judaism and you just broke one of them, which is that you separated yourself from the whole. This, of course, my feeling is, will take on an enormously ironic bent in modernity, because one has to ask, what is the whole here? From who is separating from whom? We'll get back to that later. Then comes the famous passage that we're all aware of, Va'afata haked shinav, you smack or blunt his teeth. Va'amarlo and say to him, Bavur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeiti mimitzrayim. Because of this avodah, God brought me forth from Egypt. Li v'lo lo. Then again, the Baal Haggadah is medayek to jump on the pronouns and say, me not you, me not him. Ila yasham lo hayah nigal. If he was there, he wouldn't have been redeemed, and that's the passage. Rav Hirsch, as you know, is dealing in 19th century, post-Enlightenment context. His life and works well known. The cultural milieu he's dealing in, well known, right? Assimilation on the rise, different kinds of intellectual currents already flowing throughout Europe and Germany for sure. This is a litmus test. When Rav Hirsch comes to the four children, he's going to demonstrate exactly how he feels this child should be dealt with in terms that are very, very clear, very harsh, and also enormously disturbing. Let's read what he writes. On the left column, times may come when youngsters will mock their elders, saying, what is this service to you? Yet this too shall pass, and youth will again seek knowledge and eagerly ask about the mitzvot. It will be a time when young and old will rally around the one principle that will remain a righteous duty to us, that we scrupulously perform this entire commandment. So he starts off by saying, you know, there may be initial resistance, but it's all going to come together. Let's turn the page. We will see whether that prediction holds. Before we take a look at exactly how he plunges into the issue of the Rasha, let's look at his commentary in Chumash on the Pasuk from which this question is derived, Maha Avodah Hazot Lachem. Rav Hirsch's comment begins with his Divrei Amatchil. Amartem velo and not v'amartem lahem. The Pasuk says, when your children shall say, right? Sorry. In the next Pasuk, when you say back to them, you say, v'amartem zevach Pesach. You'll say to them, it's a zevach Pesach, a Pesach sacrifice. And the note that Hirsch jumps on the fact that it says v'amartem without an object to the sentence. Right? It doesn't say you will say to them, it just says you will say, as if it's in a vacuum. Why? Because there's no one left to talk to. Right? So the entire tenor of his understanding of the discourse between father and child here is that if you, my son, have staked out this position of separating yourself from the religious concerns of Judaism, we have nothing to talk about. I will speak, but I will not speak to you. And so there will be a general speaking, but it won't be to you, raising the question, of course, to whom will it be? And the implied audience here is to people who still are not lost from Judaism. There's some folks I can still save if I talk about religious issues, but you're gone. So my goal here is that I have to discourse about religion, and I have to save other people from the harmful effects of what you are saying. So I will reply to this question, but I will not reply to you. And if you think of this in a real life sense, it's really very poignant and quite fascinating if you think of Seder tables in our time. Right? If you ask me, a Seder can potentially be a very tense experience. The general thought about Pesach, besides the sort of onerousness of cleaning, is of the joy of the Seder. But in homes in modern Judaism, where you often have a mixture of different kinds of people with different kinds of commitments and affiliations, there's actually a good deal of both tension at the table and an enormous amount of apprehension prior to inviting people, where you have situations where people of different religious commitments are at the table, intermarried people are at the table, distant cousins who you haven't seen for a long time and really secretly despise and don't want at your table. And there can be situations where some people at that table want to talk about Judaism, want to take time to discuss the Haggadah. Others are only too happy to rush on headlong to the meal. and find all of this religious stuff quite an annoying disturbance in the middle of their rush to the meal. And there are others who, in a Hirschian sense, will use the opportunity of Pesach night, one of the few nights that they are religiously involved, to cast scorn and ridicule on the proceedings. So they will actually create a version of this ma'avodat hazot lachem by picking on parts of Judaism that they don't like and creating a sense of discomfort for those around. This isn't just a Haggadah moment, of course. This kind of thing can happen in any kind of religious setting where you have people of different orientations speaking, but this is a paradigm. So Rabbi Hirsch is saying, when somebody asks that question, they've announced to you that their tone is one of derision and mockery. They don't really want to have a discussion. It's a rhetorical question. I'm not answering them, but key, I'm not going to remain silent either because there are other stakes on the table here. And that stake is that other people may be influenced by this kind of mocking question and I need to save them. So implicit in his comment here in Chumash is an ideology of the dynamics of what happens when people get together in a group and discuss religion and there's somebody in that group who he thinks is dangerous. He really expands on this quite succinctly and says the Torah does not expect any result from direct teaching or preaching to a generation which is sunk in materialism and thus estranged from God. It's interesting that he supplies a reason, a kind of socioeconomic reason for this estrangement. It's not theological. It's not because of higher biblical criticism. It's not because of all sorts of intellectual debates about Torah. I think this is actually enormously insightful. Right? In all of the discussions I hear in the modern Orthodox community about Torah Umada and the dangers of learning Aristotle and Kant, it always strikes me the same way, which is that kids do not turn off a religion because of Aristotle and Kant, because most of them can't read Aristotle and Kant. They turn off a religion for the usual reasons, because of money, because of, a sort of bourgeois desire for comfort, and so on. I'm not knocking that. I'm saying that's a fact. Religion became out of step not because people are reading Wellhausen. So Hirsch is right on that. He's saying basically they're not interested in religion anymore. It's a drag. Undisturbed by the derisive protests of a generation in which the spirit and meaning of the religious practices have been lost in the ossifying effects of materialism, he repeats it, you are to proclaim, let who will hear it, that it is still Zevach Pesachu. In other words, this kid, he's not going to hear it from me, but maybe his brother or his younger sister or other people at the table or other people in this conversation are still in a position of uncertainty. They're not sure how they think about Judaism. Not sure if they want to do mitzvot. Not sure if this is for them. And have one ear out to the mocking question. And the other ear is the one that this person is going to try and address. Because he's given up on the questioner. From a psychodynamic point of view, thinking through my wife's eyes, the psychologist, I'm very struck here again by the idea of a person asks a question to the parent and the parent answers somebody else. Right? And if you think in families where people don't actually directly communicate and the enormously corrosive effect of indirect communication, right? And Hirsch is actually advocating this a priori, saying you don't answer the kid, you answer somebody else at the table. And again, I want to take up with you later whether this is the best way of dealing with a family dynamic. It goes without saying it should be a given off the top, that I understand that from a traditional point of view, we're talking about heresy, right? Because actually that's the language of the Haggadah, is, kafar bikar, and that therefore there's nothing to say to an apostate. I'd also like to say, and this gets into what we'll get into later, that how we define the Rasha in modernity also becomes important. Because if we use that term more loosely, and we're not even talking about apostasy anymore, but it gets flipped around for anything we don't like, then you have a much more disturbing situation where somebody says something you don't like, oh, person's a Rasha, I'm not talking to you anymore. And you can think about the dynamics of contemporary orthodoxy and analogize as you will. So he says on the left column, this is why Zebach Pesach is not a direct answer to the Rasha. The Haggadah can cloak his ripos to him in the sentence Bavur Zeh, which contains the importance of these symbolic mitzvahs we have to perform and refers to the duty of carrying out the chametz and matzah mitzvahs, which we have to do at all times, even when the Pesach cannot be brought. So, a child asks a question that doesn't include him, and a father gives an answer that doesn't include the questioner. So, everybody is kind of leaving themselves out. There's no real direct discourse that's going on. Now, with that as the context and the background, let's go back to, on the next page, how Rabbi Hirsch actually comments on the Rasha in the Haggadah. And he says that the Torah, on the left column here, foresees times when the bond between the generations will be severed. Times when the younger generation not only will refrain from participating in the festive celebration and observances of their parents, but will regard it as their function to criticize their elders for living according to these observances and to undermine with biting sarcasm their parents' loyalty to their religion. So this is almost midrashic in its expansiveness. He's taking a forward question, Ma avodah zot lachem. Now, obviously, the Talmudic gloss, the Baal Haggadah's gloss on the question is also midrashic in the sense that it blows it up into a whole ideology. But Hirsch here is saying that it's war. Now, Hirsch in the 19th century felt it was a war going on. There's a war over religion. And the Rasha becomes the symbol of the person who's going to war on religion. He's not just saying, what does this mean to you? After all, if this was a drama without stage directions, right? If this was a movie script, the actor itself would insert, how are we going to read that line? It could be read very gently. Just be like, so why do you do this stuff? It does not necessarily have to be hostile. But in Hirsch's version of this child is deliberately, consciously, thoughtfully, with aformalis, going after his parent and his parent's generation and the whole tradition of religion. With sarcasm, with an attempt to undermine. And the Torah's got our back covered because it foresees this is going to happen. When the father will be seated at the Seder, writes Hirsch, in solemn joy, while the, quote, progressive son, ironically Hirsch now being sarcastic, will pass by, mocking, with the heart-rending challenge, what is this service to you? Or as the Yerushalmi interprets it, what is this bother with which you burden us every year? What to do? And Hirsch is very plain about what to do at the bottom of the page. He says, how, according to the Torah, should one answer those wayward sons who believe that their apostasy is progressive and who, turn the page, top of the right column, who call the loyalty of their fathers outmoded? To them, nothing should be said. The Torah teaches us to answer the bewildered child, the inquiring boy, and the searching youth respectively, but concerning the generation of mockers, it does not say you shall say to them, it says merely you shall say, and he refers now back to his comments in the Chumash. The answer, of course, is silence. You do not talk to this child. Why not? Why don't you talk to children who are skeptical about the tradition? Or, let's go even further, why don't you talk to children who are outright mocking about the tradition? Let's say we take it at face value, that this child, let's waive all our objections and say that this child is exactly who the tradition says. Why not talk to them? Hirsch's answer is, to such a generation, there is nothing one can say, for they expect no instruction from anyone. After all, they have progressed far beyond their elders. They have advanced sufficiently to be able to teach them. They would like to rescue their elders from their antiquated outlook, which they think to be burdensome encumbrances, and in their arrogant derision, initiate them into the wantonness and facility of their progress. Rabbi Hirsch, in much of his writing, is famous for this kind of biting tone, especially when he's addressing people on the other side. If you read some of his writings with regards to the Reform movement, this tone is steeped through. What can one say to him? One cannot expect him to change his mind. That, to me, is fascinating. one cannot expect him to change his mind. Not only does this bespeak a rigid identification of the questioner, you are who you are and you will never be anything but from my point of view, it says something even more powerful about the parent. I have no confidence that there's any discourse we could have together. All communication is shot. There's no way that I could explain my beliefs to you. I have nothing to say. I cannot even clarify. I cannot give you an analogy, an example. There's no way to light your fire. Your candle's out. Your wick is all wet. And any flame I bring to it will go out, and that's the end. So it's a comment just as much on the ability of the educator or the teacher or the parent to affect the child as it is about the child's openness. It is not difficult to understand what he's getting at here. All of us understand in situations where we communicate with other people that it's very frustrating if you feel a person has asked you a question that's rhetorical. They're not really looking for an answer. That is not the chidush. The question then becomes, do you get completely waylaid by that, by their tone? And another way of putting it is, do you get sucked in by that to the point where they've actually achieved their goal of separation? Do you say, well, you don't really want to talk to me, so obviously I'm not going to talk to you? Now, Rabbi Hirsch has a very complicated view of the matter. And he says something very striking right after he talks about the fact that there's nothing to say. Does that mean that the fate of this child is forever doomed? You got a kid. He doesn't want to do Judaism anymore. Doesn't want to do mitzvot. Keeps scoring on your tradition. Is he gone forever? So Hirsch pulls out a remarkable, kind of almost existential answer in the next paragraph. He says, the key to unlocking the hearts of this estranged generation rests in the hands of God. Only experience can bring them back. The experience of emptiness, futility, and frustration. The disillusionment with the frivolous things to which they had turned. This experience will ultimately fill their hearts with longing for the lost happiness which the ancient truth had given them. And it will lead them to confess, and he quotes a verse from Hosea, I will go and return to my first husband, for then it was better with me than now. One will have to wait for that time to arrive. Till then, one is not to tell them anything. You don't say anything to them. Life will teach them, says Rabbi Hirsch. They will taste of secularism. They will taste of physical delight. They will empty themselves out on the secular world. It will drain them of spirit. They will wake up one day and they will see my life is lost, meaningless, without purpose, without value, without direction, without redemption. And that's the only way they'll come back. Now, this to me is very, very interesting and not untrue, right? As we'll see later in a case which I will show you of somebody who essentially had that experience. But it is also somewhat desperate in the sense that it is saying that we can do nothing about this. Only people who have fully immersed themselves in the sort of wanton vanities of secularism can actually make the choice to come back to Judaism. Before then, there's nothing to say, at least in the example of this child. That leaves the last piece, which is that we're not talking to this child. This child will only learn through the byways and highways of their own life. But the Pasuk did say, V'amartem zevach pesach. You do have to say something to someone. So he takes this up next and he says, on the left column here in the middle, one is to speak up, even when all around him remain silent, or when all around him suggest that he should be ashamed of being a Jew. If they try to imply that one should not make his observance of the mitzvot too obvious, one should not raise his voice on behalf of Torah observance, then one must not remain silent. So you have here a dual character to this Seder. When challenged by the child, he will not respond to the child, but he will certainly respond. And Hirsch sees it as an imperative. And this, too, I think, is just central for thinking about Jewish communication today, that you can't just let it go. You can't just let the challenge to Judaism go by saying, oh, he's a kofer, forget about him, he'll be washed away by history, we have nothing to say. Hirsch does not feel that it is a vain event to try and defend why Judaism is true why Judaism is powerful, why Judaism needs to go on. He just thinks that it has to be appropriate to find out who your listener is. But he does not feel that once that question is asked, you know, what are you doing this Jewish junk for, that everybody should just sort of go on embarrassed at the table and say, you know, pass the matzo balls. No, says Hirsch, you got to stop right there. And you've got to talk about to the people who you think are still open to listening about why Judaism makes sense. It will not do, in other words, to simply turf this child out of the proceedings and leave it at that. You are going to have to come up with a cogent reason. So there's a certain really deep, subtle irony going on in his answer. On the one hand, not enough confidence to believe that you can overcome the resistance of this heretic child. On the other hand, quite a bit of confidence that you can articulate a position, and you should not be ashamed of articulating a position, that other people will be impressed by. One cannot be silent about one's Jewish commitments. One cannot be afraid in public situations to declare, this is who I am and I'm not ashamed. This, I think, has a good deal to do with how moderns think about religion, and especially people in modern Orthodox communities who may be harboring, not maybe, they do harbor a certain ambivalence about how they carry religion through their lives. And Hirsch is saying, one must speak up and proclaim aloud that the mitzvot which he fulfills are his most precious possessions. They constitute the bond between God himself. One must tell them that even today, he dedicates himself and his household to God by performing these mitzvot. And he says in the next paragraph, one must say it loudly, that in his eyes, he and the others like him are the progressive ones, that the performance of the mitzvot alone signifies progress in his eyes. One must say it aloud that God made his choice of Israel, right? Chosenness. One must say aloud. And this obedience is what distinguishes Yisrael from the Egyptians, and so on. Finally, on the other side of the page, Reversh concludes by saying, the sages show us that in dealing with the apostate, one must readdress the fundamentals of faith, the ABC which constitutes the basis of the Jewish child's first consciousness of Judaism. This is the foundation, and its abnegation is tantamount to apostasy. As long as he does not accept this fundamental truth without equivocation, the historical fact that the Yetzias Mitzrayim constitutes the divine seal to our mitzvot, there's no point in having any further discussion with him. Explanations of the mitzvot are only beneficial to the person who still abides by them. That is a remarkable comment. Explanations of the mitzvot are only beneficial to the person who still abides by them. You've now wiped out 95% of all current Jewish education. I, for one, would be out of a job. But that's not why I object to the statement. I'll find another job. What I'm pointing out is that contextually, all we do today in Jewish education is talk about mitzvot with many people who do not abide by them. So the question of whether this child can be analogized in the present situation must be thought about and perused in depth. To show how complicated his attitude was to these matters, we'll take a look at something else he said in a moment. I just want you to see two other takes on the Rasha in different Haggadot, especially focusing on materialism. So on the flip side here, you see the Or Sameach Haggadah, right? The well-known Rav Meir Simcha Dvinsk. In his Haggadah, how does he illustrate for us who this wicked child is? So he says two things that I think are noteworthy. On the right side, six lines from the bottom, he says, let us ponder what the wicked son is really asking. Remember that although he may be wicked, he has bothered to come to the Seder table. So there is a hopeful thought that's been repeated many times. This means that he appreciates certain aspects of the Seder, for otherwise he would have made other plans for the evening. If you stop right there, you think, oh, good. This is somewhat progressive. He seems to be saying that this child is shown up, so maybe he's open to some spiritual stuff. Not so. What is it that he likes, asks the Or Sameach? He likes the matzah balls, the wine, the charosis, all the fun stuff. So here you have a depiction of the Rasha really as kind of juvenile. He's a party animal. He just came for the food. Doesn't care about the discussion. Because of that, on the left column in the middle, he writes, it would be futile to attempt to answer him logically. It is impossible to enter into meaningful dialogue with a wicked son. A sincere discussion can take place only in an atmosphere of mutual respect, where both parties have a positive attitude towards each other. But if one of the participants is full of hostility and resentment, the other party should not bother wasting his breath. He will not be heard. So now we're setting ground rules for communication. It's not that the ground rules are wrong. They're actually right. In functional conversations as opposed to dysfunctional conversations, you do have an atmosphere of mutual respect. You do have a situation where people hold each other in positive regard, and from there, the conversation can pursue properly. The problem is that most conversations about religion today are dysfunctional. You're not talking about people who are working on the same playing field. And so if you don't take it for granted on some level that there may be a certain amount of hostility towards religion, it's going to be very difficult to make a breakthrough. And I'm sure that Rabbi Wolf can tell you much better than I what kinds of attitudes pervade in Israel between secular and religious people on discussions of religion. And if one adopted the attitude of, the heck with you, discourse would be over, and over rather quickly. Even more interesting to me is the next Haggadah, which I put forward purposefully. It's the little Midrash Says Haggadah. It's always very important to see what kids are reading. You see, at Seder tables in North America, certainly, it is many children under the age of 7 who will be reading this Haggadah, or versions of it. And in education, it's always primary to try and understand what are little kids exposed to in their earliest understandings of Judaism. Because this will be formative. In other words, they will begin to think about the Rasha now. What does it say? The Rasha mentioned here is an apikoros, denying the truth of the Torah. He has stopped doing the mitzvos because he feels that it is too hard for him. He just wants to have a life of pleasure. Intellectually, it's just fascinating that we've built this picture off of 4 words. Maha avodah zot lachem. An entire scenario of a human life has emerged from 4 words. He's a heretic. He's lazy. He's hedonistic. He doesn't mention Hashem's name at all because he wants to forget about God's existence. This pasuk refers to the time of the Beis Hamikdash when the Rasha visited the God-fearing Jews while they were preparing their Korban Pesach, and he would mock them. Why are you working so hard? What do you gain from keeping any mitzvah? See, psychologically, of course, I would say that if anybody does that kind of thing, they're desperately interested in religion. They're screaming at you that they want you to tell them why this is justifiable. Somebody who is actually disinterested and aloof is disinterested and aloof. I've met students who are aloof. They're not interested in arguing with you. They're asleep, or they're bored, or they're playing on their, you know, calculators, or they're looking out the window. Students who argue with you and say, like, what are you doing this for? What is this? Why do you work so hard? They're right in the game. I mean, they are right in there, deep, right? There's something deep in them that is now at struggle. Those often turn out to be the students you have the best conversations with, not the worst. In any case, the Midrash says Haggadah continues, in our time, the Rasha may come to the Seder table with no intention of keeping the mitzvahs of Pesach. And here we have the Or Sameach explanation, redux. He only wishes to enjoy the golden chicken soup with matzah balls or other delicacies served in honor of Yom Tov. It's also striking me how Ashkenazi the food discussions are in these Haggadot. You know, there's no sort of mention of Sephardic dishes. But in any case, turning around to the back side, they give a parable, which I'm not going to go through, just the first line of understanding the parable. The Rasha mentioned in the Haggadah is an apikoros, one who has been taught Torah but rejected it. He claims that mitzvot don't make any sense or are old-fashioned, and that one can be a good Jew without fulfilling them. Ah, So now, this seems to me a very odd thing that just happened here. There's a juxtaposition of modern cultural Jewry's position, right? What I call the Uncle Bernie position, because every year when I give a lecture, somebody comes to me and says, my Uncle Bernie doesn't believe in God and he's a really good person. You know, what do you say to that? And it's always said somewhat Russia-like, hostile, and so forth. And I said, it sounds like your Uncle Bernie's a good man. You know? But this modern sort of picture of cultural Jewry is being juxtaposed to ancient Judaism, where you have this Russia running around mocking the Korban Pesach, but saying, I can be a good Jew anyway. And I sort of long to know what exactly is the Judaism of this ancient Russia. He's certainly not a cultural Jew in the way we understand it. So there's an oddity here. So far, we've staked out a certain position in certain Haggadot where the child needs to be rejected for the good of the whole, and where all sorts of reasons are ascribed to this child for what he's doing. He's materialistic, he's hedonistic, he's lazy, he's derisive, he's mocking. We're desperately trying to fill this child with enough bad stuff to justify the fact that, bottom line, we're not going to talk to you. Okay. Let's take another look at what this actually ends up meaning. Let's look at the passage from the Michtav Mi'Eliyahu by Rav Dessler. Who is, as you all know, a giant spiritual leader in England and later at the famous Panevich Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. And in this passage, simply about Chinuch HaBanim, education of children, Rav Dessler is talking about the nature of people and how you've got to deal with a child. And speaking of mocking, he mocks modern educational theory. So he says about modern educational theorists at the bottom of the right column, Haim sovrim sha'adam nivra bli midot klal. They, the modern progressive educators, think that a person is created without sort of any innate ethical traits at all. V'rak misvivato hu lomed otan. And he just learns it environmentally. But he says, this is not so. Now, first of all, none of the educational theorists I know think that the matter of the child's development is strictly environmental. And I've talked to dozens of them, and to a man and to a woman, they all talk about a complex hybrid between environmental factors and sort of family upbringing and genetics and. However, his proof for the fact that people have inclinations from birth, and he's going to go with this by saying that the inclination is often very nasty from birth, is the pasuk that God uses in his kind of pep talk with Cain. Before Cain kills his brother Hevel, he basically, God is giving him the facts of life. He says, you know, if you let your inner bad stuff predominate, if you let your Yetzer Hara take over, lepetach chatat roveit, sin is crouching by your door. Kind of a spiritual axiom, God tells Cain. If you get depressed, if you get jealous, if you get envious, the Yetzer Hara is waiting. No problem. You'll sin in a flash. So just be careful, because it's in you. So Rav Dessler quotes this to talk about the fact that even the uber, right, even the fetus, the embryo, has instinctim ra, has bad instincts. Right? So heavy dose, right, of instinctual problems. Trying to point out that people don't become bad just because of what they're exposed to. It's in them from the start, prior to birth, and he quotes the famous Midrash, of course, about Yaakov and Esav, which Rashi brings down at the beginning of Parsha Toldot, where it talks about the fact that when they were in the womb already, Rivka would feel her belly shake and One child wanted to go out to a house of study, Yaakov, and the other one wanted to go into a Beit Avodah Zarah, a house of idolatry. And Reb Dessler is basically utilizing this to talk about the fact that children, you got to be careful with them. Even in the fetus, even the womb, there can be really bad instincts. And he keeps corroborating this. At the top of the left column, he says, Haim Sovri, meaning the educational theorists, Kitzarich, Liftoch B'Yaladim Et Atzmaut, that you need to open up independence in children. V'zuhi Ta'ut G'dola, this is a big mistake. Lo Atzmaut Sarich, Liftoch Ela Hachna'a, you shouldn't be opening up independence in them, you should be creating submission. So there is really a whole educational ideology that is unfurling here. And somewhat even more problematic at the bottom of the page, he talks about these new theorists, you look two lines from the bottom, whose goal is lechanech hitleristim chatzufim. Right, whose goal is to educate these impudent little Hitlers. It's quite remarkable language, actually. For Reb Dessler, Esav is natural man. This is what you would be if we don't break you. This is what kids will be if you don't pound them into submission in Torah and mitzvot. And therefore, modern psychological theory that children learn aggressiveness from their environment or from being punished is based on the erroneous assumption that we should teach children to be autonomous, when in fact, we should be teaching them to be submissive. And obviously, part of the problem with the Russia is he's just far too independent. The independent child, the child who thinks for himself, who simply doesn't kowtow to what he's been taught, is a major theme in 20th century Orthodox ideology, especially ultra-Orthodox ideology. But the way it's glossed is quite different. I want to give you an example of somebody who actually saw the same problem but had a radically different solution. In, from my mind, one of the more interesting books that's ever been written on education, A Student's Obligation. Before we look at that text by Rav Clonimus Kalman Shapiro, I want you to see the same Rav Hirsch on the flip side here and how he talks about Yaakov and Esav. And this is a Rav Hirsch that I think is familiar to all of you. It's widely quoted. The same Rav Hirsch who said, you can't say anything to that child, now steps up to the plate and says, parents are also responsible. See, that's the elephant in the room that no one is talking about. Right? If you read the Haggadah out of context, you open it up, drops down four sons, wicked son says, Ma avodah zot lachem, you turf him out, end of story. The question almost all of us would ask is, what's going on in this family? Who are your parents? What have you been talking about for 20 years? Do they have any responsibility? Did you just fly out of the womb this way? And interestingly, the same Rav Hirsch who says you can't say anything to this child is quite confessing of the fact that Yitzchak and Rivka made a big mistake with their children and says, on the pasuk in Toldot, Vayigdulu ha-na'arim, that the boys grew up and began to be different kinds of people. Esav became the hunter, and Yaakov became sort of more passive, more tent-dwelling. Hirsch's comment on the first paragraph is to point out that each child must be treated differently, near the bottom of that paragraph, with an eye to the slumbering tendencies of his nature, and out of them be educated to develop his special characteristics for the one pure human in Jewish life. Famous pasuk from Mishlei that is always quoted, Chanoch al pi darko, educate the child according to his path, is employed here. And he goes on to say that when Father Jacob visualized the tribes of our nation and the son standing around his deathbed, he saw not only future priests and teachers, he saw around him the tribe of Levites, the tribes of royalty, of merchants, of farmers, of soldiers. In other words, he saw diversity. He saw not every kid is the same. He realized that he's got 12 sons and they're all different. But, says Rav Hirsch on the next paragraph, just because of that, because each one has to be brought up al pi darko, to try and bring up a Jacob and an Esav in the same college, right, using contemporary language, make them have the same habits and hobbies, want to teach and educate them in the same way for some studious, sedate, meditative life is the surest way to court disaster. Because Esav, he says at the top of the next column, can hardly wait for the time when he can throw the old books and at the same time a whole purpose of life behind his back, a life which he has only learned to know from one angle and in a manner for which he can find no disposition in his whole nature. You blew it, Mom and Dad. You didn't realize this kid doesn't want to sit in yeshiva 14 hours a day. He's a physical guy. You got to take his tasks, what he's got, you got to harness it. You've got to look for what's special in this child, and you've got to make him the best Jew you can, but in relation to what his real potentials are, not the potential you fantasize for this child. It's amazing how unflinching he is to say this. And now he goes on to talk about the lack of psychological astuteness of these parents by saying, had Isaac and Rebekah studied Esav's nature and character early enough and asked themselves, how can even an Esav, how can all the strength and energy, agility and courage that lie slumbering in this child be won over to be used in the service of God, then Jacob and Esav, with their totally different natures, could have still remained twin brothers in spirit and life. Didn't see it, didn't diagnose it, didn't apply it properly. So, of course, at the end of the day, when we have, in Chazal's term, a Rasha, right, the forerunner of the Edomite Romans, whose fault is it? The discussion of whose responsibility is this, what happened here, is entirely absent from the passage of the four sons, and yet it's the one that, to me, comes first to mind. I pointed out before that an entirely different solution to the problem of this independent thinker is proposed by the Rav of Piazetsna, Rav Clonimus Kalman Shapiro, who's known more famously as the Esh Kodesh, right, who perished in the war, who was one of the great Hasidic rabbis of Poland before the war, and he wrote in 1932, Kuntres Chovat HaTalmidim, a tract about the obligation of the student, a student's obligation. Now, he starts out in a similar way to Rav Hirsch and many others by saying that the education of each and every child must therefore be different depending on his nature, mind, character, and all his other unique qualities. And the educator must become aware of these qualities. It will not suffice for him to know himself in his own mind alone, since everything depends on the student who's being educated. It should be required reading. You don't teach kids just what you know. You don't depend on your mind alone. You teach kids by knowing who they are. Doesn't mean you tailor everything that you're teaching to their mindset, but to be oblivious to their mindset is to court disaster. And not only that, the point of imposing knowledge is not so that you stuff them full of knowledge, it's so that you can create a person who has internalized the value of seeking out Torah for its own sake. So you've got to create the desire for this person to do this when they're older, because frankly, you're not going to be around all the time. You're not going to be there to push them, you know what, did you pick up a sefer? Did you go to Minyan? Or, in the case of many of the populace I teach, have you done anything Jewish lately? Says Rav Shapira at the bottom, left paragraph, every father and every teacher knows that their children and students will not remain children forever, but will eventually grow in years and possibly in Torah knowledge and spiritual devotion. Yet there exist fathers and teachers who are concerned only with what they see right now. And since all they see right now are children, the goal of their efforts is to educate their charges to become good children. They wish to infuse them with only a child's measure of Torah and awe of God. This they consider sufficient. Wrong, says Rav Shapiro. They must see the children sitting in front of them as great souls, still immature. Their task is to get them to grow and flourish. It's always very interesting to me how discussions about kids and children take place. You'll have parents talk about how good their child was at the Shabbos table. Rivki came home with her Parsha questions, and she knew every one of them, and she can tell you all the information. And what about Yitzchak? He wasn't that interested. He's bored when the Rebbe talks. He did ask a kind of interesting question about Torah. Right? So, what's happening with Rivki and Yitzchak? What do we really want for them in 10 years? Do we want somebody who simply ingests information but actually left to their own devices, doesn't really think independently about the material? Says Rav Shapiro, a teacher is a gardener in the garden of God. And actually, the gardening metaphor is central in Chovat HaTalmidim. He uses it often. Even if some of the children seem rebellious or flawed in their character, the teacher must know that the nature of soul seeds, of unripe angels, is to taste bitter as they are ripening. There's your Russia, right there. Bitter as they are ripening and to be filled with nectar in their maturity. You don't give up on this child. Just because it tastes bitter now, you do not give up on this child. Why? Because of something he feels is ontological in the being of the Jew. Neither the nature nor any particular quality of a Jewish child is absolutely evil. Stop. This is what the holy Baal Shem Tov and his disciples have taught us. There is, of course, a whole Hasidic undercurrent here of optimism, of looking at the value of the child, of not giving up. But he goes further. He now itemizes for you this quote-unquote Rasha. And he says in the middle, take another example, a child whose personality has an angry quality. Angry children. True, the way the child is expressing his anger at this point in time is extremely bad. But are we able to therefore decide that he is from a corrupt source, that he is inferior and base by nature? If an idiot heard the praises of the etrog fruit, grabbed a seed or an unripe etrog and bit into it, and then shrieked and howled at how bitter and poisonous tasting a fruit the etrog is, would we not laugh at him and consider him a great fool? If you make a judgment prematurely on how somebody is developing, and you think that's the whole story, and you don't see how it turns out afterwards, it's the same as somebody taking a fruit that's not ripe and biting it and proclaiming with supposed great wisdom, oh, this doesn't taste good. It is impossible, says Rav Shapiro, to predict ahead of time how great a benefit may emerge through the efforts of the principal or teacher from the very anger of the angry child. One must penetrate into his inner life, bring him close, ignite his heart and his soul until they are dedicated to God. Then his anger will be transformed into a fire from above. You don't suppress it, you actually channel it. Try and take the anger and make it work. What's the child angry at? Is the anger a symbol of great spiritual energy burning inside of this child? By no means an easy task. Let's not be foolish about this. Angry kids are hard to deal with. They're hard to deal with in a classroom. They're hard to deal with at home. But he's trying to say that this is not a quality that's irredeemable. What is it that the child is protesting against? How can that midah of protest be used in ways that are enormously beneficial to the klal? Instead, as he says on the next page, how are we dealing with our children? Remember, he's writing this in 1932. And think about the present educational system in Judaism around the world. Use a little split screen. We should be heartsick, however, and our hair should stand on end when we see the way the younger generation has turned to heresy and has lost all spiritual discipline. They possess neither faith nor fear of God nor knowledge of Torah. They have come to despise God and his servants, the people of Israel. So there you are, almost 75 years ago, saying stuff that could be written today about the television internet age. Now he says something even more striking. The administrators and deans of the yeshivot, who are totally immersed in the life of the yeshiva and its students and encounter only the elite of our youth, are unaware of the gravity of this problem. They console themselves saying, yes, it may be true that many of our young people have freed themselves of any commitment to Torah, but still, Israel has not been abandoned. There are still young men, sons of our people, outstanding in their Judaic scholarship, whose heart is steadfast with the Lord. I've had occasions of talking to educators about kids in their yeshivot who I've run across who are not fitting the bill of the yeshiva, who are in fact so not fitting the bill that it's striking that the administrators are not quite aware of what's going on with this child. And on a larger level, what's been communicated to me is that on the whole, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to produce Gedolei Yisrael. We're trying to produce people who can lead the Jewish people in learning. And so the ultimate goal here is, yes, there are going to be some people lost along the way who, you know, do not find their way in learning, but there's a larger good. Says the Eish Kodesh, poke your heads outside of the four cubits of your yeshiva. You will see the great mass of people who have broken from the observances of our faith. May God have mercy on them and us. You will see houses of study where the destruction of Jerusalem has been reenacted. Once they were filled with Torah scholars, now they have become empty, and instead, groups and organizations whose goals include the dissemination of heresy and the rejection of Torah has been filled with members. Ultimately, he says on the right column, we tend to look at the straying of our youth as if they alone were to blame and we were completely innocent. God, however, declared the following about his relationship to Avram. I have made myself known to him in order that he command his children and his household after him. Every generation in Israel is a link in the chain of our heritage. Every generation receives its faith, its Torah, and its sense of awe from the generation that preceded it. And this chain, if this chain has been broken in our generation, can we truthfully put all the blame on them? And of course, the answer is no. So for the Russia child, there's a parent, parents, family, community, school out there behind the context of this passage. I want to spend a little time, before I close, looking at the opposite view. The view that the Rasha is here to be redeemed and not scorned. Now, of course, your number one candidate for here, not surprisingly, would be Rav Shlomo Karbach, because that was Shlomo's way. And in his comment in his Haggadah about the Rasha, he says the following. Says Rabbi Karlbach, let me tell you about the four children. Some children are good, some are the best, some are clever, some are not so clever. Seder night gives me a taste of how much God believes in all of them. Sometimes you see young people that are a little off. You know why they're off? Because there wasn't anyone to believe in them. It's so easy to get off the highway when no one believes in you. Our holy rabbis teach us that the chacham, the clever boy, let's turn over to the next page, right column at the top, is very beautiful. Chacham is very beautiful as long as you think that being clever is everything. Interesting, he even gets in a subtle dig towards pure intellect without any other midoth. The chacham is intellectual, he needs to be taught. How about stopping being only intellectual? How about tasting the afikoman, tasting the depths of life, feeling deep emotion and serving God with it? The clever person isn't far away from the wicked person. Who do you think the wicked child is? Someone who was never told how holy he is. Then there's this remarkable piece of Belzer Torah. I wouldn't say it's necessarily pshat, but he's making an ideological point. It says, blunt his teeth, right? Smack the Russia's teeth, and we know Russia, Reish Shin Ayin on the outside, a wicked person on the outside, but Shin coming down through the middle. So he says the Shin, with its three prongs, is Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So inside of this Ra is a Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Inside of this wicked child is an ember, a deeply buried spark of Jewish spirituality. So what do you do when you blunt his teeth? It says, if you want to educate this boy, knock his shin loose from the rest of him. Meaning uncover, unearth that spiritual part of him outside of the Ra which is constricting him. Tell him not to make you think that he's not holy, because you know that he really is holy. Obviously, a completely different approach to what you're doing with this child. No fear of dissemination of heresy. No fear that bad things are going to be said at the table. Why? Because for him, it's worth it. We'll have to risk in our time, in our generation, hearing things which are not kosher if we want to be able to reach the child. And you're making a kind of cost-benefit analysis here. You're saying, is it worth trying to speak to this child even if stuff gets talked about in front of my company that is embarrassing or that is not, you know, traditional? Says Rav Shlomo, if it matters to you enough, if this child's soul matters to you enough, then you will forego formalities and you will go for it. Something similar said in the Bratslav Haggadah on the backside, where he talks about the Rasha is translated as the wayward self. And he says the following on the left column, 10 lines from the bottom. The tzaddik also makes it clear that when we hear the wayward self raising these questions within us, it does not mean that we are evil. The questions of the wayward one are asked. They are answered. And once answered, others, including the others inside ourselves, are silenced. There's no Russia at the table other than us. There's no Chacham at the table other than us. There's no Tom at the table other than us. There's no inarticulate Sheino Yodei Lishol other than us. I want to close by referring to Rabbi Hirsch's solution. The solution of existential emptiness, meaning that the only thing that will get people back to Judaism is the taste of secularism. This is not untrue. It's not fully true, but it's not completely untrue. I get asked a lot by high school students, by college students, about their sense of religion as automatons, as mechanical, as slavish, as robotic, as a giving up of autonomy and independence. One of the things that is important for every person in this generation to understand is that nobody is free. It's just a question of what you're going to get enslaved to. And it's a question of being self-aware that that is true. Probably the greatest delusion people hold is that if I'm religious, I'm enslaved, and if I'm not, I'm free. And to be unaware of what you are serving puts you at a distinct disadvantage. If you look in the Gemara itself, there's clearly an understanding of this in Sanhedrin and Perek Chelek, in which Rava said, Kulo gufe derobtake ninhu. All bodies are instrument of toil. Tove de lezachi dehave drobtake deraisa. Fortunate are those who merit to be toilers in Torah. There's different glosses of this by Rashi, but the bottom line is human beings are receptacles. They're vessels. Something's going to fill them. You're going to get filled by something. If you're not filled by Torah, you'll be filled by something else. The illusion that somehow I'm immune to cultural influence is ludicrous. And so it behooves us to understand that when you're talking to a child who's alienated from Judaism, Hirsch is right in a sense. Do not surrender, do not feel embarrassed to talk about Judaism straight. To say, this is why we feel mitzvah has power, this is why we feel this tradition has truth. And you never know. I want to end by telling you the story of a man, Yair Kaspi. I hadn't heard of Yair Kaspi. My colleague, Rabbi Asher Cohen, told me about him. He's a psychologist who lives in Israel. If you look on the last sheet, the very last one, which is in Hebrew, this is from his book. It has been translated in English. It's worth reading. It's Lidrosh Elokim, to seek out God. In the opening chapter of the book, Yair Kaspi, at the time, was almost 30, says the following. One who seeks out freedom will not find freedom. Mechapsei chovah efshar sheimtzu chofesh. One who seeks out obligation may just find freedom. Elu hayu hadvarim sheshamati et Aisha omer. Those are the words I heard the man say. Umikan, and from there, hidchalti liot adam acher. I began to be a new person. The person who said this to him was Yeshaya Leibowitz. As he says, Zekara lifnei asrim shana, 20 years ago, b'dirato haktana b'rchov Usishkin, in a little apartment on Usishkin Street in Yerushalayim, haya Professor Leibowitz milamed b'chol motzei Shabbat. He would teach every motzei Shabbat, a small study group, and he began teaching them the Kuzari, and he said, quoting the Kuzari, Avdei Zman, Avdei Avadim Heim. Servants of time are the servants of servants. But the servants of God, Harim Leibowitz at Kolog, he raised his voice, Hu Levado Chofshi. Now, the ending of the story isn't, you know, textbook stereotypical. It's not like, you know, Yair Kaspi became an Orthodox Jew or anything like it. But he did change his life. He did go out in search of spirituality. He did try and make God center to his existence. Here's a secular man. You look at him, basic sort of secular interest. You write him off. Can't write him off. In education today, there are two problems. One is rigid self-identification, and the other is rigid identification of other people. Rigid self-identification is when people have decided what their religious potential will be, and that's it. I just went through a Shabbaton where a lot of times what I heard students say was, but I'm just not that. They've locked themselves in. Forget about other people locking them in. They've locked themselves in. And I talk to them about the straw men that allows them to escape. What I mean by that is they'll say, well, so-and-so practices religion and, you know, he's not a very nice guy. And I said, so you're going to use that one as an escape, are you? It's not a question of being somebody else. It's a question of what we can be, of who we can be. And at the end of days, it's not going to be, was I so-and-so? Was I me? And one of the reasons that children have begun to rigidly self-identify is because they've been identified by others and locked in, and that's it. So the question in our generation, Rabbi Hirsch notwithstanding, is whether we are going to take Avad Yisrael seriously or not. We sit down on the floor in Tisha B'Av and we go through a whole process of talking about Sinat Chinam, but there's an enormous amount of phoniness going on. A lot of fake talk about Avad Yisrael. It's not a question of Jewish unity anymore. It's a question of whether you can dialogue and talk to people that you don't agree with. You don't have to agree with them, but can you talk to them? Can you take this Rasha at the table? And can you speak to this child? And you take responsibility for how you may have created these conditions. And can there be some kind of redemption that comes out of this? I think how we think about these issues will tell the tale on what kind of Judaism we have in years to come. Thank you very much.